This podcast is brought to you by The Province.
Listening to Book Rogues with your host, author, and Province Books blogger, Peter Derbyshire.
Welcome back to the Book Rogues, everyone. Today I'm joined in the Province Podcast studio by Elizabeth DeMariafi, author of the story collection How to Get Along with Women, which was long listed for the Giller and shortlisted for the Relit Prize. And she's also author of the best-selling novel The Devil You Know, which has been acclaimed everywhere and is being turned into a TV series. Elizabeth was in town for this year's Vancouver Writers Festival, which we profiled in an earlier podcast, and she's kind enough to take some time out of all of her appearances to talk to us. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for inviting me in.
All right. First of all, why don't you tell us about your debut novel, The Devil You Know, for those two listeners out there who haven't read it.
The Devil You Know is a kind of a thriller, and I always describe it as a kind of a thriller because I didn't really set out to write a thriller. The way the book came about for me was really an image that I had of a young woman standing inside her bachelor apartment. And she's standing there and it's nighttime and it's very dark outside, but her lights are on. And while she's standing there looking at the blackness of the window, outside her house, there's a cat and a raccoon kind of get into it, and one of the neighbor's motion sensor lights go on. So for just a minute, the whole back of her house gets illuminated and she sees that there's a man standing on her fire escape looking in at her. And then the motion sensor light goes off. So that was sort of the genesis of the book for me. And I started to think about who is this woman? And that woman turned out to be Evie Jones, who is a young reporter. She's about 21 years old. She's working her first reporting job at a newspaper called the Toronto Free Press. And the book is set in 1993. Which is an important year for lots of reasons, but in the news, of course, that is the year that Paul Bernardo was arrested for the murders of Christian French and Leslie Mahaffey. So this is one of the things that Evie is going to end up doing, is sort of sitting in her car outside of Paul Bernardo's house in Port Dalhousie, watching the forensics teams go in and out of the house, which is, you know, sort of not a great job as a reporter, and there's certainly some indication at the time that even her newsroom knows that they're not going to actually find anything immediately, so she's kind of been sent down there. But Evie also has a backstory, and her backstory is that when she was 11, her own best friend was abducted and killed, and it's a cold case. So aside from everything else she's doing, she's going to use all of the tools of the trade she has in the newsroom, including the brand new internet, to try and solve this cold case.
And so why that specific time period of you know, not only the Bernardo investigation, but that particular stage of the Bernardo investigation?
I got really interested when I was writing the book. As I say, I didn't really set out to write a thriller, although it did turn out that way. But I thought that I was writing a book about fear. And to me, having also grown up myself, you know, I'm sort of roughly the same age that Evie would have been in 1993. So I grew up through those years in Toronto that were so marked by the Scarborough rapist and then those murders of the girls down in Niagara. So I really was interested in placing a novel in that moment of fear, that if you had grown up sort of internalizing all this fear, how much would you trust yourself if you were anxious? How much would you trust yourself if you thought you had a stalker? And of course, that becomes Evie's question with this stalker. Does he exist or does he not exist? Has she now internalized so much fear that she's kind of got an overactive imagination and she's always trying to talk herself out of things? But I think that is actually a very common experience that women have.
So this image you had of the man outside the window, is this just like a random one-off image, or do you have those kind of moments more often than that? Like, where did that come from?
In the moment that I started thinking about it, originally I thought that would be a short story, actually. I thought that it would be a short story about the relationship between this young woman and the stalker she thinks she might have. But you know, I became rapidly concerned with the idea that we had one character inside the house and one character outside the house, and they never speak, and actually one of them might not exist. And that had huge potential to become a boring story, and I was not interested in writing a boring story. But you know, sort of in the beginning of the book, the book's written from Evie's perspective, and she sort of talks about all the all the ways that, that women are sort of constantly imagining and thinking about their own safety. When I'm walking down the street, I'm going to walk. If it's late at night, I'll walk in the middle of the road, away from the sidewalk, away from the hedges, and I'm going to look behind myself. I'm going to turn right around sometimes. And if I keep doing this, then there can never be anything behind me, because that would only happen in a movie. And it's these sort of safeguards that are like really anxiety based that I think that women build for themselves. So the image that I have had of Evie standing in her apartment, which, you know, is an apartment I once lived in when I was 21 and living in Parkdale in Toronto. That seemed very, very real to me, that if you were really worried about somebody being out there, that you would almost not trust yourself if you thought you saw something, in the way that we all hear creaks and see shadows move, you know.
Mm. And what did you learn during the writing of this book? You know, was there anything about the Bernardo case that surprised you, that it was unexpected or anything like that?
What was really interesting to me was I thought I knew a lot about that time, because, of course, I did live through it. And the book is not really about the Bernardo case. The Bernardo arrest is the backdrop to this wider story that is really about Evie investigating her own friend's abduction and murder. But even that story is largely based on, we had a spate of young girls, little girls, who went missing in the 80s in Toronto. And so even Evie's fictional friend, Leanne Gagnon, is sort of roughly based on an amalgam of some of those little girls, Sharon Keenan and Alison Perrott, really big cases that are stuck in my memory. But as it turns out, what I had was more of an emotional memory of all of that. I had an emotional memory of the girls who went missing in the 80s and also the Bernardo case, meaning I remember how it felt, but I didn't actually remember a lot of details of the case. Mm. So in terms of the Bernardo piece, one of the things that was really interesting to me was to go back and look at newspapers, because, of course, Evie's working in newspapers. So not only just for the facts of the case, but how it was being reported, how it was set up on the page, you know. And I'd find, you know, there was an interior page I remember really starkly, because it was at the time that Kristen French was missing, I believe. So there was a map of where all the girls had gone missing in Niagara. And there were actually three, because there was a girl, Terry Anderson, who I believe has never been tied to Bernardo, but that she also was missing at that same time. And nobody knew what had happened, so they assumed that it was all the same perpetrator. So there's this map of where all the girls have gone missing, and then on the left-hand side of the page, there's an account that's come through the Associated Press of an American journalist who has written his account of witnessing a serial killer be executed in one of the states that still had execution. And then the bottom of the page was an article about Charles Manson applying for parole again. And I thought, wow, like, what inundation for me to have to go back to that time and go, wow, like, it's not even just Bernardo. It's that this sort of this fear machine is really doing its job. But, you know, in terms of facts about the case, I was not very interested in dropping a lot of facts about the case, because, as I said, to me, this is not a book about Bernardo, and nor was I interested in dredging things up in a way that would be at all disrespectful to the victims or their families. I wanted this book to do the work of elegy for the girls who had gone missing. It's a book about missing girls, really, when it comes down to it, and I wanted to give them as much of a story and as much of a voice as I could, because I think the story always goes to the killer, and we lose the girl the second she disappears.
That's an excellent point, yeah. You had a connection to a missing girl in your past, didn't you?
Yeah, when I was 9, my own best friend went missing, and that is Sharon Keenan, who I just mentioned. So, you know, as I say, I remember, obviously, I remember that time, but to me it is really an emotional memory, and that was one of the things that was so interesting, is I did have to go back and do quite a bit of reading about that case, and I was surprised by how little I knew about it, that I really, and that I had actually conflated things, and what I thought I knew about it was not actually accurate, of course, because I was 9, yeah. Right? And Evie is very, very much the same, where this has all happened to her when she was 10 years old, and her friend was 11. and she doesn't actually remember what was going on, and she's trying to put together her own memories. And then now as an adult, she's going to try and put that together in a way that is professional, and she's going to try and solve things, which, you know, is a, certainly a step further.
Right. And book's been out for a year?
Not quite a year. It came out early this year, so we're just heading into the paperback release will be just before Christmas.
Perfect, yeah. And what did you learn? We talked about what you learned sort of while you were writing the book, and what did you learn after the book came out? Because there was such an incredible response to it. Like, I can't think of a book I've seen, you know, a response like that too, such a wide and emotional response to the book. So what did you learn after it came out?
Well, it was actually really interesting because in the months, you know, between the book sort of being out of my hands, but also not in stores, I did have this worry about having, you know, written about these things or about the perception about and the book being about Bernardo, which, as I said, it's not really about Bernardo. But and one of the nicest things was that as the book started to get some pre-publicity, I got a bunch of emails. And I got a bunch of emails from women I did not know, who I'd never met, stranger emails. And every one of them said, I am so glad you're writing about this. Can we finally talk about this now? And I thought, that is really powerful to me. That's really powerful.
So before the book was even out, you were getting these messages from complete strangers.
And so obviously that allowed me to sort of move into the book's release feeling a little more confident about my own choices, because, and I think that this is actually the crux of it, I think that this is exactly what happens, that these girls go missing and we get the fear, but we don't ever move beyond that. We don't talk about what that's like. And what is it like as a woman to walk through life with this fear? And one of the things I say so frequently is, imagine the amount of mental energy that women are actually putting into this. Is there somebody behind me? When I go into the car park, I have to check the back seat. We're told from the time that you're trained to be a babysitter all the way through, like, you're constantly doing all these sort of safety checks. Like, imagine if I could apply all that mental energy to my career. You know, but I also have had a lot of communication from men, which has been fantastic, and I wasn't really sure what the response from men would be. And uniformly, the men who have chosen to get in touch with me anyway, all say this. They say, wow, I knew it was bad. I had no idea it was this bad. And today I was, you know, going to get onto an elevator after hours at work, and there was a woman waiting for the elevator with me, and I just let her get on, and I took the next elevator up, and I thought, wow, you figured it out. That's exactly it.
That was me, actually.
Oh, was it you?
in this very building.
I have other examples.
I'm sure more than one man has actually said that. No, I mean, I do that sort of stuff. I do the crossing the street, so I'm not walking down the same side of the street. And, you know, if it's nighttime, I drop back, so you're not...
Exactly, which has nothing to do with you personally.
No,
it just has to do with the sort of the story that I think women get told over and over again, which is, if someone's walking too close behind you, you have to be really careful. If someone gets into the elevator right behind you, you have to be careful. So when you've been told that story literally hundreds of times, then, you know, it's deeply respectful to cross the street.
Well, and it's, you know, like what you were just saying about, you know, walking down the middle of the street and all that. It's, as a guy, I know that, you know, you guys are more safety aware than we are. I would never even think about that sort of thing. But even knowing that, the level of what you have to think about is just, it's surprising and you know, depressing. And you know, it makes you feel bad as a guy, too, I think, that you guys have to go through this. So how did the reaction sort of continue as the book came out?
Well, the book really had incredibly positive reception. There's no question. I was so pleased, but also a little bit surprised. It's my first novel. And, you know, we hit all the national reviews on the weekend of book release, to the point where, like, the book was not actually in all the stores yet. Right. And reaction was critically very, very positive. And since that time, every time I do a reading, you know, I have five, six, 10 people sort of waiting to talk to me about these exact things. And sometimes they have a personal connection to a story, and sometimes they don't. And it, but the personal connection is that we were all there through this. And that actually extends far beyond, you know, Golden Horseshoe of Ontario, which, you know, was something that I wondered about. You know, like, I'm not, because I lived in Toronto, I had this very Toronto experience of this story, and this stuff being in the news. But absolutely, in terms of the people I've talked to in British Columbia and Saskatchewan and East Coast of Canada, that that this sort of hit everybody in the same way as a community. I think we were really traumatized by it. So people, yeah, I talk to a lot of people. I get a lot of emails. I do get a lot of messages from women telling me their own stories. And some of those stories are quite sad.
What do you do with those stories? Respond to them?
Yeah. I always send a response. You know, one of the things I think that we do as writers is create a climate of conversation that a book, if you're lucky when you're writing a book, your book goes out there into the world and continues to grow, because it's growing in people's minds and creating a climate where we can, and especially for me with this book, creating a climate where we can, you know, move beyond the fear and actually start talking about it and start talking about what the effect is and, you know, how to move forward. How do we move forward as a community? And when I say community, I mean like all of Canada.
Right. And has this changed anything? Can you know, writing a work of fiction actually make a real difference in the real world?
I really hope so. I think that's fiction's role in the world, beyond being a good narrative and a good story and an entertainment. And I think that fiction certainly fulfills all those roles. But there's no question that that fiction has a political role as well. I think of this as a political book. I think of it as a historical book in some ways, even though it's recent history. It's very much rooted in its time and its moment.
So what happened between the first book, the collection of short stories? Because I think some of these issues were present in that book too, obviously in different forms. And that book did very well. I mean, I think it was sort of a small press book, but it, you know, was really punching above its weight, right? Like, you got on the short list for the Relit and that Giller Long list, and I think they got a lot of critical reviews. But The Devil You Know just exploded. So what was the difference there? Was it the Bernardo case, or was it something else? Novel versus short story?
It's probably a huge combination of all those things. I imagine. I think novels always get more attention than short stories do. I love short stories. I love writing short stories and I love reading them. But if you are a short story author, I think the number one question you get is, so when are you going to write your novel?
Usually from agents, right?
It's actually the question across the board from everyone. We like novels. We like novels because it gives us time to, you know, to get to know a character and to be in that world. And you know, when you really love a novel, I think universally you get to the end and you go, oh, I don't want this to be over. I don't want, you know. I think the nicest compliment I've had is I get many people asking me if I'm going to write another book about Evie Jones.
Really?
And I had not initially ever considered that. I just, you know, I don't even know that I will write another thriller in this vein, because to me it's a very specific book. It, you know, this book ended up being a thriller because of the kind of story it's telling, but also because I was really interested in the sort of the friction between the subject matter and the thriller genre. We know that women are big consumers of thrillers. They're big consumers of true crime, much bigger than men. So why is that? So I got really interested in that part of it. And I wanted to write a thriller that was about what made women really afraid, which is sort of what this book ended up being. Having said all that, now I'm working on something new. And every now and then I think, oh, maybe in a few years it would be really nice to to see Evie do something else, because I really loved her by the end of the book. Obviously, I really you know, she's kind of smart mouth, and I enjoy I enjoy her.
Well, you totally captured that whole world of journalism. I mean, I wasn't working in it at that particular time period, but it rang pretty true to me. So, why do you think it is that is that women are the bigger consumers of thrillers and mystery fiction and that sort of thing. Why is that?
I got really interested in that. And during the time that I was writing the book, actually, there was a study, like an academic study from the States that was released. I wish I had the link for you here. I have it saved as a bookmark because I was so fascinated. And I didn't even really realize until this study came out and got some press that women were the biggest consumer of true crime. And I went, oh, well, that is really interesting. But the point of the study was why, is this like vicarious living? Is it, I wasn't sure either. And I read the study and unanimously the answer appears to be, we read this stuff so we can learn how to get away. So I actually gave that line to somebody in the book.
Wow, yeah.
Because I thought, wow, that is like a hammer hearing that. Right, that women are actually reading true crime, and there is a part of a woman's brain that's like, well, this is a bit of an instruction manual. Let's see what not to do. Right,
it's a rehearsal for their own attack.
And I think that that's what all that sort of anxiety, imagination stuff is as well. It's a rehearsal. What if this time I turn around and there really is a guy following me? What will I do? Upsetting, but I think that to me that was a really powerful piece of news, and that certainly that informed the way I was writing the book.
So tell us a little about the TV show, film rights are sold. What exactly is it going to be?
The option was sold to New Metric Media, and right now it's in development to be a television production, which really thrills me because that's sort of was my leaning with this book to start with. So New Metric is run by Patrick Sullivan and Mark Montefiore, who are great guys to work with. I can tell you that already. And they've already brought on a showrunner for the prospective show. While we're still in the development stage only,
yep.
But the showrunner will be Karen Walton. So Karen is really well known in Canadian media. She's one of the big writers for Orphan Black. She also wrote a real cult horror movie called Ginger Snaps.
Oh, really?
Some people might be familiar with.
Yeah.
Anyway, Karen, she and I have done some speaking in the time, and I'm just absolutely thrilled. Like, I could not imagine a better person to be on this, to be working on this show. So
that's amazing.
So yeah, so I've got my fingers crossed. I'd love to see Evie on TV.
Yes, as would we all. Yeah, you recently had the opportunity to read with Margaret Atwood, right? And mm-hmm. So you're having all of this. Well, first, tell us, what was that like? Because Atwood's got a reputation as sort of being this stern icon of can lit. That must have been a little intimidating.
It was only intimidating until the actual reading. It's intimidating for me. I mean, I don't think anybody has informed my writing and my career the way that Atwood has. So if you look at those short stories, when you were talking about them mm-hmm. earlier, like my short stories are, I would say, uniformly interested in power. And I think that we could argue that this book, which is about fear, well, fear is just the other side of the coin from power. that's Margaret Atwood's influence all over. But beyond that, showing women, I think, of my generation how to write, what Atwood did was show us how to have a career as a writer and how to aim at that rather than, just writing a book. And I said that at my reading. I like to think of it. I read with Atwood, but I was first. And I said, well, I'm sort of the opening act. but she was absolutely nothing but lovely and generous to me. Very positive, and immediately bought the book and tweeted about it. I couldn't be more pleased. I mean, that, a huge icon for me personally. So
that must be amazing, to meet the person who's influenced you, and they turn out to be a good person.
Oh yeah, it was.
You never know.
She was so generous to me. It was really nice.
And what's it been like to process all of this success? Because you've had a lot of success with this book, right? And the typical can-lit sort of path is you start out in obscurity and you kind of claw your way up to the next level of obscurity and hopefully someday you actually get out of the mud and somebody might notice you, you know, 5 or 6 books in. But, you know, you kind of hit it out of the park with the first novel, and that's not the usual can-lit experience. So what's that been like to just process all of that?
I just sort of really take it one day at a time. I think the fact that I do get a lot of personal correspondence from readers is really helpful with that. That I feel very engaged with this book, and I feel engaged with the people reading it. And that's made this sort of a wholly positive experience for me. You know, and then I get to come to Vancouver to do Writers Fest, which is such an incredibly well-run festival. And, you know, again, your audiences are so engaged. And so I feel very close to it still. You know, I'm trying to work on a new project, which is hard sometimes when you're still touring the old book, and I sort of have this nostalgia for Evie because the new book's quite different, set in a different time in a different place, and I think, oh, remember Evie? it's been really wonderful. You know, my assumption was that I was going to climb the obscurity ladder the way you just illustrated for us. I've been very lucky. I feel very lucky. The short stories I published my short stories with Invisible Publishing, which is out of Halifax, a really, really great small independent press, who were really wonderful to me. I was obviously over the moon thrilled that the book was longlisted for the Giller Prize. And that made a really big difference, you know, in terms of my visibility, especially with a book of short stories, because short stories just don't get the attention that novels usually do. But my timing was also really lucky in that I had been working on the novel, and I was, you know, when that nomination happened, that we were, you know, my agent actually already had a first draft of the novel sitting on her desk. Sometimes it's, you know, it's timing.
And I don't want to minimize that first book, because everybody was talking about that book, How to Get Along with Women. And it's, you know, fantastic book. And it was a beautiful looking book. Like, that was one of my top reads of the year. I was, you know, totally blown away by that book.
Oh, thank you, Peter.
But it was just, you know, the next one came along and was just like, boom, it was everywhere.
Well, right? much more visible. And it had, a lot to do with, I think at the time the book was sold, it was sold to a Canadian publisher and then separately to an American publisher. So it got a lot of sort of deal news in book media. There was a buzz about it. Nobody was expecting a literary thriller from me. I'm pretty sure that is part of this, post short stories. I don't know what was expected of me, but perhaps not this. I think the Bernardo piece is part of it. And I hope that that's true in the best possible way. Then, in the way that, as I said, you know, I have people coming and saying, can we finally talk about this now? So maybe it's just really time to talk about it now. You know, we're a generation on. I know Stacey Bay Fowles, who's a Toronto writer, has a nonfiction book about growing up in Scarborough. And she's a few years younger even than me. But I believe she went to the same high school that Bernardo did. So she's got a nonfiction book about that time coming, I think, in 2016, but I'm not 100% sure of that. So that'll be something to look for as well. But so that tells me the fact that, you know, there's more than one of us who need to go back and figure this one out.
Well, it sounds like, unfortunately, there's a whole generation of people who need to go back and figure it out, you know, judging from all the messages you've received. You said on your blog a couple of times, when do we riot? What do you mean by that?
Well, that particular post went up last March. So that was in response to the verdict coming in the murder of Cindy Gladue. If you're not familiar with that case, Cindy Gladue was a First Nations woman. She was a sex worker in Alberta, and she was really horrendously, violently murdered by a John, basically. And when the not guilty verdict came in, it was sort of, it was sort of unbelievable to me. There were many unbelievable things about the case, including the fact that that the Crown actually brought in a piece of her body as part of the proceedings in court, and that is never happened.
An actual physical piece of-
Yeah, and so that's so there's the level of disrespect there was just really huge. But beyond that, just looking at the straight up details of the case, the fact that this was like 100% not guilty verdict was sort of more than I could stand. And I think that it was so egregious to me, and it was so obvious that, you know, every now and then something happens where you think, oh, I can't take it anymore. And I wrote a blog post about it where I just said, you know, as a woman in this country, sometimes I wonder if the real question is, when do we start rioting? At one point do we say, and of course we had lived through at that point, I am so pleased to say it is now in the past, but we had lived through almost a decade under the Harper government that just continuously defunded women's centers and women's programs. So, you know, there was that part of it too, but that was really where that post came from. But really what I was doing in the post was stridently asking that we all request an appeal, respectfully request an appeal, and providing some information to help promote a letter writing campaign. So, so riot is a very strong word, and I felt very strongly. but the letter writing campaign was in fact successful, and an appeal has been launched. And not only that, but we in the end had a day of action in early April of this year that extended from St. John's, Newfoundland, all the way to Victoria, and I think we had 27 cities in the end that had a demonstration at the same time. So it was like a wave, you know. So 2 o'clock in St. John's time, and then 2 o'clock in New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, you know, rolling out across the country all the way to Victoria, which I found so like incredibly positive that out of something that felt so negative to me, that you know, that I think we really stood up and did a very positive thing.
And so here we are, we're recording this days after the downfall of the Conservative government.
Still gleeful.
Well, my question is do you think things will change under the Trudeau government, which I don't think anybody expected the majority government? We were all sort of calling a minority government, perhaps vote splitting that would let the Conservatives back in. But, you know, very few people were saying, hey, I think this is going to be a majority. And then when I was watching the polls on the province website that night, and then Maritimes came in, I think pretty much all red.
100%.
I was like, wow. So what do you think? Are you optimistic?
Yeah, I'm really optimistic. I think you have to be optimistic, but I think beyond optimism, we need to also stay vigilant. I have a lot of optimism about the Trudeau government. You know, he's a very obvious self-declared feminist. You know, a lot of the campaign promises sound great. But at the same time, I think actually now, especially in, let's say, the first 6 months of this government, this is a great time for us all to keep the pressure up. He's got, I don't know exactly when this is going to air, but in the next 6 weeks, he's got actually a number of fantastic opportunities to show us he's going to be progressive. He's got there's a climate change conference he needs to go to. There's G20, there's the TPP. There's so many opportunities now in the next 6 weeks, not least of which is, you know, he has made a commitment, as far as I know, to launching an inquiry into missing and murdered Aboriginal women. And I'm waiting to see that actually happens. And I think that there are many, many women across the country, and men, many, many Canadians across the country are waiting to see that actually happens.
I think most Canadians are probably keeping a close eye on things over the next little while. Yeah. A couple more questions before we wrap it up here. So you're married to the poet George Murray, and I should point out that George is a longtime friend of mine, and as are you. So full disclosure here. What's it like living with another writer and sort of, you know, another famous canlit figure? Because I would say, well, George is infamous. Let's say infamous.
It's great. You know, and I know people who say that I know other writers who say that they don't think they could live with a writer. For me, I think it's actually perfect. Now, that might have more to do with George as a person than George as a poet. I'm not sure, but you know, we do a lot of, you know, trading work back and forth. I know I can really trust his opinion. He's so respectful of my work regime to the point where we share an office, and I'm not sure that George has ever actually gotten to work in that office. Like, he pretty much works at the dining room table. I get to work at the office, which is so lovely.
Well, we could probably make a joke about poetry and fiction there in offices, but... But you also keep everybody out of the office, right? Do you tell us about your no?
Well, actually, when I was working on this book, this is The Devil You Know, that I created this situation. George and I both came to the marriage with children of our own. So it's a blended family. And as a result, we have four children all together in the house. And of course, sometimes they have friends over. So you can imagine how crowded it all gets. I really had limited time. I was working a day job at the time that I wrote this book, and I had limited time, and I needed my office time to be sacrosanct. So I put a large sign on the outside of the door, hand-lettered in magic marker, and it just says no. And when the door is closed, the no is pretty much at face level for whoever might be there. And it's meant to be a preemptive answer to any question. You know, can you make me a sandwich? No. Can you drive me to the mall? No. Can you help me with, you know, this, that, the other thing? No, no, also no. And if you knock on the door and need to get the no from my voice, your life is about to turn bad. Something bad will happen. So that has actually worked tremendously well. I've had to sort of reinforce it now that I'm working on something new. And the newest piece of this, the corollary to the no sign, is my good friend Miranda Hill, who's also a very fine writer. She said, well, you need to put a sign on the inside of the door that says yes. So I've now also done that, so that when the door is shut, they see the no, but I see the yes.
That's lovely. I think I'm going to steal that. Okay, final question. If you could live inside any book, which book would it be and why?
Oh, my God.
That's what everybody says.
Do other people answer this question properly?
Oh, brilliantly. Every single one of them. God. No hesitation.
That's a nightmare. What a nightmare question. Gosh, I don't know. The books, to be honest with you, probably the books that I remember most sharply are not realities that I would like to live in. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of what I've read recently that I just loved. Anne Patchett's Bel Canto. Well, that's about a whole room full of people who've been taken hostage. I don't really want to live in that reality, but it's a fantastic book. What a question. I don't think I can answer it.
That's okay. Okay. You know the books you don't want to wind up in.
Yes. Yeah, I would rather not live in The Handmaid's Tale.
Perfect. Elizabeth, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Book Rogues with your host, author, and Province Books blogger, Peter Darbyshire. Listen to new episodes available twice monthly on Saturday mornings, read Peter's blogs on theprovince.com and on peterdarbyshire.com, follow him on Twitter at Peter Darbyshire, and join him on Facebook at facebook.com/Peter Darbyshire. Listen and subscribe to this and other Province podcasts by searching iTunes or visiting theprovincepodcasts.com. Thanks for listening to this episode of Book Rogues.